time forks perpetually towards innumerable futures. Jorge Luis Borges. Welcome to this week's episode of Warfare, Advancement, and Revisionism. My name is Preston Floyd, and as always, I'm your host. I'd like to thank everyone for joining me this week. I appreciate the support. If you're a newcomer, welcome. I hope you'll enjoy and go back and listen to our backlog of episodes. And to any returning listeners, thank you guys as always. Again, your support means a lot. This week's episode may be a little rough. I am traveling for the Memorial Day weekend, and my recording setup's a little bit different, so if the audio is a little crappy, I do apologize, but I'll try and get things edited out and boosted if we need it to be. This week, we will be covering Neolithic cultures of the lower Yellow River / Yellow River Delta between the years of 6 and 4000 BC, BCE, whichever of those options you prefer. Before that, though, I did have one item from last week's episode that I did want to clarify. When discussing the Bonpo sites, I made mention of them having ditches. I mentioned the theories that they were defensive or used to help corral animals, but I think I neglected to mention that they may have been a very rudimentary type of flood control, which is obviously something that's very important when you're living along the Yellow River. So, you know, that's also a very real possibility. Of course, there's a likelihood that the ditches were dug for a combination of all three of those reasons and maybe some others that were not talked about. So, with that out of the way, let's go ahead and dive into the subject, or the primary subject for this week's episode. We're going to start with the Huli culture. The name comes from the type site of, you guessed it, Huli. The etymology of this name is one of the more difficult ones that I've had to figure out. In fact, all the names in this week's episode are a little difficult to kind of figure out. But the character for Li used in the name of the site can mean plum, and that's plum tree or just the fruit. But it's also a surname, and in the past, it could have meant something like a judge or justice of the peace, though that definition isn't really used in modern Chinese. Now, Ho has a couple of definitions in addition to being a surname. It can mean lordly or kingly, though typically it was used for women, so it was mostly used as a queen. I think that is what the modern Chinese name for the queen chess piece is. Though this usage is obviously also a little old-fashioned. Another definition is more of an adjective, you would say. It can mean after, behind, later. And this is a lot more common in modern usage. So the name might be translated as Later Li or New Li. Probably the current town was built near an older settlement just called Li that itself was the site of fruit trees or a justice of the peace. Now, the Huli culture is not quite as old as the Pelagong or Xiahu cultures, but the timing of their emergence lines up closely to the Xishan. So they emerge around 6500 BC, though their artifacts don't last as long. They disappear around 5500. Their type site at Huli was first excavated in the late 80s and early 90s. Now, the Huli culture was not very widespread. They occupied around 12 sites, all within the modern Shandong province. And they were located in a territory south of where the Yellow River flows into the Yellow Sea and north of Mount Tai, which is the easternmost and arguably the most culturally important of China's five great mountains. And we'll talk more about that when we go into Chinese religion and things like that. So far, only five of their sites have been fully excavated, and none of these sites are particularly large. No more than 100 or so individuals. And they all had fairly simple but well-made pottery that was either kind of gray or an off shade of white. Most of their tools were stone, but they also had tools made of bone and antler. Most of their sites had domesticated animals like dogs and pigs, but one of their sites, Yuzhong, did not. only wild animal bones have been found there. These sites also had access to rare stone, things like jade. Now, the Huli also had grinding stones with feet that are identical to Pelagong examples. And these are the only artifacts that are identical to the Pelagong artifacts. And as the Pelagong are older, it's currently thought that this was an example of technological diffusion down the Yellow River. Now, like the Yang Shao sites, the Huli dig down their floors, but all of their homes were rectangular or square-shaped. They did not have round homes. I couldn't find any mention of their burial practices, aside from the fact that they included grave goods, and there didn't appear to be differences mentioned between the amount of grave goods and the sex of the individual who was buried. They tended to be buried in communal graves on the outskirts of their villages, but that's about as much detail as I can find. They grew primarily foxtail and broomcorn millet, and even a small amount of rice in a couple of cases, though, again, not that much of it. They were much more reliant on broomtail and broomcorn and foxtail millet. And of course, as always, you know, they were still hunting and gathering as well. So, while agriculture was certainly a substantial part of their diet, it was not their, you know, necessarily their primary, but it was, you know, at least a third of their diet, if not a little bit more. Now, around 5,500 BC, the Huli sites are abandoned and their tools disappear from the archaeological record. Well, their tools and pottery. At least at the sites that have been excavated. Who knows, they might dig them up later, some of those other sites, and discover, oh yeah, they hung around at least at a couple of these places for another couple hundred years. But regardless, all of them have been abandoned that have been excavated so far around 5,500. And it takes around 200 years, but after that point passes, a new Neolithic culture emerged, and this is known as the Beijin. And their artifacts are then found in or near sites that the Huli had occupied. And it is believed they are descendants of the Huli, or at least a sizable part of the Huli population had descended, a sizable part of the Beijin population had descended from the former Huli peoples. Though, of course, the Beijin will occupy much more area. They will spread out a lot farther than just that little narrow strip of plains between the Yellow River southern bank and the north of Mount Tai. Now, the Beijin have been known about longer than the Huli. Their first type site was discovered in the 1970s, and the breakdown of the name should probably be something like Northern or North Labor. I think the site was found near a railway that was used to, like, transport workers to, like, various sites. So it could have been, like, the Northern Labor Depot or something like that, but the depot just wasn't said. It was just implied. But it's hard to get a firm breakdown of that name. As I mentioned, they did expand out from the footprint of the Huli. So in addition to being in the Shandong province, they also moved south into what is now the Jiangsu province. And they carry on a lot of similar food production. Of course, millet cultivation is important. It's still, you know, well, at this point it becomes probably their primary source of food. But in addition to cultivating pigs and having domesticated dogs, there's also evidence that they have begun to domesticate or have obtained domesticated water buffalo and even possibly chicken, though chicken is a little bit hard to nail down, as I talked about in the chicken domesticated episode, because their bones are so small. Sometimes they'll shift a few layers deeper than they actually existed under, but at the very least, they're probably starting to farm some type of poultry, at least towards the end of their, cultural occupation of these sites. We also have a lot more evidence for them fishing carp in the Yellow River, and they did not, of course, give up hunting. They hunted deer, and they harvested a lot of wild pears, and plums and things like that, in addition to like root vegetables and tubers. We know that they used hemp to create fibers and weave fabrics. They also made baskets and a lot of different kinds of ropes and fishing nets. They did not, as far as we can tell, grow hemp directly, but the area was filled with wild batches of like wild hemp. In fact, the area at this point in time, like a lot of different places, was much more forested than it is today. But the forests in this part of China actually lasted for quite a while into the historical period, where it was made special note that the area was, you know, heavily forested. Now, of course, as time has gone on and deforestation has progressed due to, you know, nearing needing to clear space for agriculture, but also just to have wood for fuel and things like that. So it's not nearly as forested as it once was. They keep the circular housing and the subterranean flooring from the Huli culture. Their pottery becomes much more sophisticated. And they have, I guess, a wider variety of colors. They gain kind of this kind of red tinged and colored pottery. They begin to bake their pottery at extremely high heat, and they begin to make a lot more variety in terms of the type of pottery they're making. Jars, tripods, they have both round and flat-bottomed and ring-footed bowls. They don't really have any pointed, jars or anything like that, which, you know, if you think of ancient Greek amphorae, you know, similar to those kind of points, they don't have anything like that. And they don't really have any painted designs, though they did impress them with corded markings from, you know, the hemp ropes they were making. But they also did not get rid of their gray pottery, but all of their gray pottery does begin to have red bands underneath where they're kind of like making lips and things like that because of the firing process. And that's probably how they gave more of their pottery just straight up red color. But they don't abandon the gray pottery completely. So again, that's part of the reason why a lot of people think they're kind of an extension of or a descendant of the Huli culture. Now, one of the things they've noticed from the burials at these sites, and speaking of burials, again, grave goods, very similar to the Huli culture, though the people buried tend to have more of them. And again, there's not a distinction between male and female in any of these burials. And all of the burials occur outside of the village, bounds. And there are groups of people buried together, and then there are breaks, and then you'll have another group of people buried together. So people think they're maybe in, like, family burial plots or something similar to that. Now, from these burials and from their, you know, more varied source of protein, I guess, if you look at their domesticated animals and what they're eating, they appear to be very healthy by Neolithic standards. You know, a lot of Neolithic sites, especially the first few generations after people become sedentary, typically they are not as healthy as their hunter-gatherer neighbors or counterparts. And don't get me wrong, the Bayesian are probably still not as healthy as your neighboring hunter-gatherers, but they are much more healthy than any of the other Neolithic people nearby them in preceding, I guess, cultural layers. But, you know, they are, again, they are the most healthy Neolithic people, at least so far discovered in China, at least at this time frame. Obviously, there are some a little bit later who were probably better off, but that's after they had adjusted to the fully sedentary lifestyle. And of course, they had evolved, you know, ways to deal with all the things like gluten and stuff like that from growing domesticated foods. Also, I haven't really brought it up too much because, you know, some of this stuff is obviously Hard to judge just based on the skeletons, but a lot of Neolithic sites, you know, there is a lot of evidence of violent deaths, you know, skulls broken, bones broken, you know, which doesn't necessarily mean people are fighting each other. It could be, you know, dealing with animals, or they just could have had really bad accidents. But those examples among the Beijing are very, very low. Most of the people buried have no real traumatic injuries of any type. So it's thought that they were, you know, fairly safe, mostly peaceful. They apparently didn't have poor relations with any of their neighbors or each other, at least at any large scale. So that is, you know, that's something. And again, remember, there are a lot more Beijing sites than there were Huli sites. I think, again, I think there was around 50 Beijing sites compared to 12 or so Huli sites. Now, these sites are all fairly small. I don't think they got too large. So their populations in the villages themselves did not really get that much larger than the Huli sites did. But, of course, there were a lot more of them. So I guess even though, you know, they're better off, they can't really sustain this with too large of a population. They kind of have to keep expanding out from, you know, or creating new settlements in different locations to kind of be able to keep that, I guess, standard of living high. And that's not something that's going to change either. The next Neolithic culture that we'll be talking about, they also expand their number of sites, though they do get a little bit larger. And this culture is known as the Dawan Ko culture. The name comes from the Dawan River, which flows north from Mount Tai, I believe, into the Yellow River. Dawan Ko is something like the Dawan's mouth culture. It is a continuation of the Beijing. The Beijing sites do not disappear, essentially. The Dawan, I guess, the innovations that the Dawan sites have initially slowly spread to the other Beijing sites, and basically it becomes like, it starts as like in the interior of the Beijing culture, and the innovations at the Dawan sites spread to the rest of the Beijing sites, and all the Beijing sites are then considered, you know, Dawan Ko sites. The Beijing, and this happens fairly quickly. The earliest Dawan Ko artifacts show up around 4,300 BC, and they begin to spread out. And by 4,100 BC, they basically replace all of the Beijing culture artifacts. So about 200 years. It's a very quick spread. Now, again, there's no sign of violence or anything like that at a large scale. So this isn't like a hostile takeover of like a couple of cities or a couple of villages over the rest of them. This is just a slow, well, I guess not really slow, at least in terms of Neolithic terminology. But, you know, it's a steady spread of a specific kind of art style over the rest of the Beijing sites. And the Dawan Ko is going to last for quite a while. It lasts until about 2600 BC. And as time goes on, you'll see more and more interactions between the Dawan Ko and the Yangshao sites. And the Dawan Ko will last about 2600 BC. So about 1,700 years. You know, pretty good run. And the end of the Dawan Ko happens just before the end of the Yangshao. And as we'll talk about next season, there are some reasons why they disappear around the same time. But as we're going forward from this period, every year, as both of these material cultures expand, they're going to become closer in terms of trade. Now, there's not too much overlap culturally and materially, other than like raw materials and certain manufactured artifacts, which we'll talk about more. The Daewon Co, you see them produce a lot of jade artifacts, which are very valuable for trade purposes, but they also add more turquoise and ivory artifacts as well. So they're making a lot more, we'll call them non-practical items, in addition to, again, continuing production of actual valuable, well, I wouldn't say that. So in addition to producing, you know, very similar types of, or continuing very similar types of food production as the Beijing, they're producing even more, shall we say, luxury goods, for lack of a better term. They're also expanding culturally. They create alligator drums, which is exactly what it sounds like. They are drums made from alligator hides. Essentially, they would take clay pots and then they would stretch alligator hides over them, and they would use that to make music. So you have the invention of the flute in China a couple of episodes ago at Jiahu, and then downriver during this period you have the invention of the drum, although I'm sure they've had drums before, but or at least something that makes a similar sound to drums, but now they're actually producing I guess, a more common example of a musical instrument. I don't want to go too much into their material advances because, again, a lot of them don't really take off until next season after this time period has ended. But I do want to go over, I guess, a couple of things that we know about the Daewon Co that is kind of a radical change. So they begin to practice cranial deformation, which is where, again, where you take an infant before their skull is set and you kind of make their heads certain shapes. We've seen this in other places in the Neolithic, specifically kind of in the Zagros Mountain border regions between Mesopotamia and what is now Iran. So we have that. There's also dental ablation, where they're removing specific teeth from basically everyone's jaw. And these are healthy teeth, usually. So this is kind of a cultural distinction. Maybe interacting with the Yang Shao, they wanted to kind of identify themselves amongst each other. Maybe this wasn't something everyone did. It was specific people who did it for whatever region or for whatever reason. But that is one of the big changes culturally you see happen. Their pottery becomes a lot more distinct. They continue to kind of innovate on things, and they also, again, they create new types of vessels that haven't been seen before. But they also have some symbology that doesn't really line up with anyone else. One particular thing that they add to their pottery, and this shows up in a couple of different ways, and it does evolve over time how it's displayed, but they have a circle over kind of almost a crescent, and I'll put a picture in the YouTube video of it, but some people think it may be the sun, like over a cloud, but then as time goes on, they begin to incorporate sun-like designs in other pieces of their pottery. They don't really have any human representations on anything, at least that I saw in the collection of their art, which is also something that's a little bit different from people upriver at this same time. But we're just getting started with the Daewon Co. They continue, again, a lot of this coloration and styles of pottery that the Beijing do, but again, they will continue to innovate and expand on those as time goes forward. But we'll return to the Daewon Co next time, and I'll go into a little bit more detail on them next season when we talk about the interactions between them and the Yang Shao culture, specifically the Yang Shao phase of the Yang Shao culture. Now, there is one other theory. Some people think that kind of what kicked off the innovation among the Dawan Ko is a group of outsiders coming in and joining parts of the Beijin. There are theories that perhaps people coming downriver from where the Jiahu or Pelagong culture were. They think they may have come from there, and they may have joined the Beijing remnants, or these could have been people coming up south. But again, this is all kind of speculation. I think some of the remains of the Jiahu and the Dawan Ko people, they look, some people think they look fairly similar in terms of, I guess, morphology. But again, that stuff's hard to tell. But I think DNA testing has shown that they were closer to ancient northeastern Eurasians. So that, you know, they're closer than, say, people from Taiwan or southern China. At least that's from the remains that have been found and that could be tested. So just make of that what you will. Also, the Dawan Ko, they do expand the number of sites they have. I mentioned the Beijing had about 50 sites associated with their culture, whereas the Dawan Ko, that gets up over 200, which they have not excavated nearly, comparatively, they have not excavated that many Dawan Ko sites. I think they've done over a dozen, but there's a lot more that haven't been kind of dug into. But that's all stuff we'll save for next season when we return to this region and we talk about the Dawan Ko. But I think that is going to be it for this episode. I hope you guys didn't feel like it was rushed or anything. I hope the audio quality is good. I will, again, kind of try to boost my audio a little. It does look like it's okay, but it is a little low from what it normally is. So I'll try and get that taken care of. I'll try to add the photos and all that. I hope to have it up at its regular time. The audio version definitely will be up at its regular time tomorrow or Monday for you guys, Memorial Day. But the YouTube version with pictures may take a little bit longer. We'll have to see. Again, I am traveling for Memorial Day. I do plan on celebrating this evening with a couple of friends. So we'll see how that goes. But at the very least, the audio version will be up, and I'll try to have the YouTube version up sometime tomorrow. But I'd like to thank everyone for joining me. I do hope you have a safe Memorial Day or whenever you listen to this. And next week, we'll be finishing up the Neolithic cultures of China. And I do kind of want to talk about Chinese historiography, what they understand about this portion of their history, at least historically speaking, because like the Sumerians, you know, they have very old stories, some of which would conceivably fall into the time frame that we're talking about. And I will kind of go into some myth stuff as well, though it won't be quite as in-depth as the Sumerian stuff, because again, a lot of the stuff that the Chinese have written about the period probably comes from a slightly later kind of understanding of prehistory. But that's all stuff we'll go over next week. But we have one more Neolithic culture to talk about, and that'll be kind of tied in with, again, the kind of mythology and mythical history of China. But I hope you'll join me for that one. But if you guys have any questions, feedback, constructive criticism, please let me know. You can direct message me on X/Twitter. You can comment on the YouTube video. You can send me a direct message on, or you can email me at waradrevpod@gmail.com. All are viable. Please like, download, subscribe, all that kind of good stuff. And I'll see everyone next time.